pick it up. And there's journals and things like that.
We're ready whenever you are, and Kara's going to actually have her first ever experience muting the host when the host is not speaking.
So did we do, we didn't do a level mic check yet, did we? Or you did
yes,
it while we,
did.
We were talking?
Yes.
Okay. Was it a subversive mic check? Okay. So what I, so rolling?
Tape rolling or?
Okay. So could you just start off by telling me your name and your occupation?
Okay. My name is James Latham, and I'm the director of Radio for Peace International, as the co-founder of the station as well.
Okay, great. What is Radio for Peace International?
It's an international shortwave station, mm-hmm. and that probably should be explained a little bit because not everybody knows or are familiar with what shortwave is. But there is some bands of shortwave bands that exist between the AM broadcast band and the FM band. And these bands are some 13 altogether, are quite large, and because of their nature, the signal on those travel around the world. So where you find like Radio Havana Cuba or Voice of America or the BBC is on those shortwave bands.
Okay. So what's the, well, the mission of RFPI, that's Radio for Peace International, is to spread messages of peace and social justice. Is that correct?
It is not much different than what the mission of Pacifica or the National Radio Project is, and that is to give a voice to the voiceless, to broadcast those programs that are not heard on conventional radio, to share those around the world to other peoples, and to focus on the areas of peace, disarmament, human rights issues, social justice issues exclusively. So everything that goes on the air on Radio for Peace International would be covering some of those areas. We don't have necessarily polka music or something like that being played on the radio station. It is in those general areas that we try to cover.
Okay. And what is the University for Peace?
The University for Peace was founded back in the early 80s by some real visionaries, Dr. Robert Mueller, who'd spent many years in the UN system, and it was proposed by a Costa Rican president, Dr. Rodrigo Carazo. Both these gentlemen have very good intentions for the University for Peace, and had tried to put forth a university that would have peace studies, human rights as its mainframe for education, as its platform. And unfortunately, for many years, the University for Peace had kind of stagnated and financially had a lot of difficulties. Like most endeavors in the area of peace, they were very much underfunded. And so they had a considerable amount of difficulties getting it really up and running financially. And thusly, it never had a lot of students. To this day, it has about 50 or 60 students, so it's very, very small. While its grounds and its campus is quite large, the faculty is reasonable size, the student body is quite small. And it has existed in financial difficulties, I think, up until about 1999, when Marie Strong came in and took it over.
Okay, so he came in and took over the university?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, would you say the mission, the university's mission is in line with the radio station's mission?
The mission of the University for Peace, as it was originally stated, was in line. Certainly, what Rodrigo Carazo did was to invite people, organizations, grassroots organizations into the University for Peace system because as it was initially started, it was just a simple shell. There was not much there, a substance. The ground was located. It's in a beautiful preserve out in the countryside in the rolling hills of the Central Valley of Costa Rica. And the idea was to bring on external projects that were underway to the grounds of the University for Peace to allow them to have some facilities to operate from. And we were one of those organizations, Radio for Peace International. When it was first started, the idea was to, the concept was just to build it in our backyards, our backyards being in the state of Oregon at the time. And the late folk singer John Denver had heard about us and connected us up with Rodrigo Carazo, who then invited us down to the University for Peace grounds in 1986.
Okay. Why did the University for Peace shut down RFPI?
There, as I mentioned, there was a change of guard at the University for Peace. Marie Strong came in late 1999 and started to reorganize. Initially, the discussions with him regarding the radio station, he was very positive, knowing that the radio station was self-funded, it was listener-supported, that it had built its own facilities, its own office and studios and transmitting facilities. And Marie Strong at the time acknowledged that in a very positive way, but asked if we would want to give up our autonomy that we had always had to be included into the University for Peace system. And at that particular point, he gave us three options. We can give up our autonomy, dissolve our board of directors, and become part of the University for Peace and thusly share in its new funding. Or we could continue independently and have mutual programs together that we would decide on. Or we can be totally independent in our operation. And of course, at that particular time, we were very happy to become continue to be independent and to work on mutual projects together. So the difference really that occurred between us is short time later, in 2000, Marie Strong started to mention to our then director that we were going to have to move. We were going to have to go. No reason given at that particular time. And we asked on several occasions why was this coming about? What was the reason for this? And there was no response, no reasons given to us for that. Later on, it became kind of apparent that there was an agenda at the University for Peace because things had started to change in terms of the programs that were at the University for Peace. For example, in 1999 or 1998, the School of the Americas had a reunion at the University for Peace. This is something that during his opening discussion, Marie Strong had indicated that the University for Peace in the future would have military people coming for some sort of training. It wasn't specified to the grounds. So some of us have considered the possibility that, you know, it's quite possible the University for Peace and Marie Strong didn't want a independent journalists, a nest of them, if you will, at the radio station in their backyards reporting on this kind of activity.
Did anyone challenge that School of the Americas reunion at the university?
There was. It was done very quietly. I mean, there was, it was on a weekend. It was when asked about what are all the cars up there and everything at the University for Peace. It was, we were told that it was some visiting governments coming to the University for Peace. There was very little knowledge about it at the time. If it had been known, the people of Costa Rica would have protested against this and would have challenged it. But none of us were informed on that as to what was going on. There has been since then. Another development, and that is there is a U.S.-supported school, a police school, that is trying to be placed in Costa Rica, and that has found a lot of protest against it. A lot of people who have been very concerned about such a school being constructed in Costa Rica by the U.S. government. And that group has also visited at the University for Peace as well.
Who is the university accountable to?
It's very interesting because we have, in looking at this from a legal standpoint, to take our case to somebody to to have a, you know, a tribunal on this, as guaranteed under the UN Declaration of Human Rights, we have not found anybody that is really they're responsible to. The Costa Rican government themselves, they have autonomy from the Costa Rican government and from the, much like an embassy would have, for example, so they don't have to answer to the Costa Rican government. Costa Rican government, the president of Costa Rica, had offered to mediate in the case between the University for Peace and Radio for Peace International. That was turned down by the university. They don't have to. The university does not have to answer necessarily to the UN. There has a certain amount of autonomy written into its creation from the UN, being that they are self-funded and they do not receive monies from the United Nations. So they have, in some respects, the quite a bit of autonomy from both inside the country and from outside. The body, the governing body of the University for Peace is called the Council. It is, and as its president is Maurice Strong, the person that has really been instituting these changes.
Okay. So you were talking about the agenda that the university has. It seems very bizarre that the university would host a reunion for a most obviously non-peaceful organization, like the School of the Americas. I don't know if you'd call it an organization, but so can you speak a little bit more about the agenda or the alleged agenda that the school might have? Get into that a little bit deeper.
It is unclear as to what exactly they are doing at the University for Peace. There has been some indication that Maurice Strong wanted to build some condominiums nearby. It has a very small student body at present, and it has not been very clear in terms of what exactly they want to do with the University for Peace. One thing is obvious is they want to make profit. They want to see it financially to grow, and so we are concerned, the staff of RFPI and others that have been watching this university in recent years, as to exactly what are their priorities. Are they going to continue in the area of peace or what? We have talked to some of the students from the University for Peace. They have indicated that to a degree a dissatisfaction with the kind of education that they are getting. This has been such people as past individuals working in the World Bank or the IMF who've come and given lectures more or less holding up those institutions as beneficial. Some of the students have question such such thought and have been censored from asking questions to such visiting lecturers. So it certainly from Maurice Strong's background, here's an individual that has spent some time in the oil companies, being the CEOs of oil companies, of working in coal companies. Is the advisor to the World Bank, has been involved in the World Economic Forum. This kind of background, business-oriented background, is very influential, I believe, in the current University for Peace and the direction that they're going to take. That's not to say that everyone working in the faculty of the University for Peace believes in that. There certainly is some There is dissidence in the staff, in the faculty, but it does tend to influence heavily, I think, the direction that the University for Peace is going. And I might point out, of course, that Central America right now is embroiled in efforts to stop CAFTA, for example, a so-called free trade in Central America. So there is a struggle against this kind of action, economic action by the Costa Rican people themselves and other Central Americans.
Can you give an example of the struggle, perhaps a concrete?
Sure. Again, one of the people that has been very involved with that struggle is the founder of the University for Peace, Dr. Rodrigo Carazo, a past president. During his presidency, he had informed the International Monetary Fund that they had 24 hours to leave the country rather than submit to some of their demands on him and on the people of Costa Rica. So he's been very involved in organizing and talking to other politicians in the region and in Costa Rica. Just as I left Costa Rica around November 6th, there was some major demonstrations against CAFTA and in the streets, unions, teachers, people who work with the utilities, which are all publicly owned in Costa Rica. CAFTA would have an effect of privatizing those institutions, and those institutions have been built up on the taxation of the people of Costa Rica. So they're very concerned about losing such institutions, and they are able at present to have reasonable electricity, reasonable phone rates and such, and they cannot afford to have such institutions privatized and to see those costs increase. Also, the union element is very strong in Costa Rica, and they're very concerned about losing the unions to this. So there was a major, major demonstration throughout the country that filled the central Paseo Colón of Costa Rica with protesters complaining about this. On the other hand, the present president of Costa Rica has pretty much gone along with this liberalization of the country and agreed to sell off some of these public utilities.
Okay. So right now, does Radio for Peace exist?
Right now, it exists in boxes. The station, after a period of aggression by the University for Peace, for more than a month, we were virtually locked in, and we were inside the station, afraid to leave. The staff was afraid to leave the station, concerned that, and we were told if we did leave, we would not be able to return inside the radio station. So we stayed, and as we did, we watched the barbed wire fences go up around the radio station. At a certain point, the electricity was cut, and the water and the telephone lines cut by the University for Peace officials. The radio station is located on the grounds of the University for Peace. Listeners supported and built the office and studios and the transmitters, but the facilities, the utilities, come into the facility via the University for Peace grounds. So at a certain point, the groundskeepers were told to use a machete and cut through the water line and cut through the telephone line. This left the radio station without water, without telephone, and at a certain point without electricity. The staff, some of the staff, continued to stay inside. We had to have canned food thrown over the fence so that we would be able to eat. And we collected rainwater so that we'd be able to wash and drink, have some water to drink. It was very, very difficult times. at a certain point, the aggression was stepped up, and we had to make a decision to really inform the volunteers, and the radio station has numerous volunteers that make it work. We had to inform the volunteers not to come in because it was looking a bit dangerous for them. And so we did that. And we had to make another really tough decision, and that was to leave our office and studios, the buildings, and pack up the equipment of the radio station to remove it because we were concerned about its safety, and we wanted to get that out. So the radio station was boxed up over a period of about 4 weeks and moved to a couple different locations. Some land was donated in Costa Rica where the transmitters went, and then we had several offices that were offered for storage of our studios. And this is a complete radio station, you know, so it's quite a bit of equipment, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment that is now being stored currently.
So you said land was donated in Costa Rica. Was that offer taken up? Or?
Yes. It is. It's going to take some effort because it's not. There's no buildings there. It is just bare land. But there has been some land donated that will be high up in the mountains of Costa Rica, and at this particular time, we're really looking at the future of the station as far as how best to put this back together. How can we, starting sort of from fresh from a start like this, how can we best serve the people of the region of Central America as well as our listeners around the world? And one of the things that, as our equipment, one studio goes to one location and some other studio goes to another location, we said, you know, this is not such a bad idea. Since our station covers all these regions, let's set up a studio in the Limon province where there is a strong African-American community with indigenous and Latin American community there. They don't have a community station themselves. They don't have a radio station there, but they can hear our station, and there's numerous people in that area that have tuned in and listened. And so why not set one of the studios up there? Another one will be in San Jose in the central. We have some people that are working in Panama right now that want to have a studio. So we developed a plan of having these remote studios set up around Central America for our listeners to produce programs and be in touch with their communities, to send these programs then into the main center to be broadcast on shortwave. And so it sort of evolved from this move, kind of a new approach to how we would connect our studios and our transmitters all together and better serve the Central American region.
Turning a negative into a positive.
Yes, yes. Awesome. And a lot of people are very excited about that because, unfortunately, in Costa Rica, there is no area of community radio that really has been involved in that. It's mostly commercial radio, and there is very little community radio activity as we know it. And so this is a way to perhaps get those areas involved in the community type radio.
What about internet? Will you be using that at all?
Yes. We always looked at the internet as an expansion, but not a replacement for the shortwave broadcast. Living in Central America, one realized how few people really have the ability to connect up to the internet.
People in Central America or everywhere?
Well, everywhere, but mm-hmm. in Central America as an example, you have very little opportunities to hook up to the internet and to listen to a radio transmission on the internet. While the internet works real well for the countries in the north, For the South, it's very difficult. It's very expensive for a lot of people to hook up. A few people will have high-speed internet connections, and they can do that. So one of the formulas that we were working out is, how much should we spend on sending our transmissions to, say, North America or Europe, and how much we should really focus our transmissions to South America and Central America, the Caribbean and Africa, areas that will not be well connected. So we can perhaps better serve this information flow coming from the South, going up to the North on the internet, and then information from the region of Central America to flow out to the South on shortwave, where shortwave radio is still widely used, of course, in these areas. So that is sort of the it's still being discussed, and there's a lot of things to work out, but it seems like the internet will be something we'll do, mostly for our North American, our European listeners, and then the rest will keep shortwave focusing on Africa and South America.
How popular is shortwave radio?
It's very popular. There is a tremendous amount of shortwave sets around. Certainly for the northern countries, shortwave has been reduced somewhat. I think there's something like 13 million, for example, in the United States, shortwave sets running around, which is a sizable amount. So it's much more popular, of course, in the countryside versus larger cities. It's much more popular in areas that are somewhat remote. And, of course, throughout Latin America, you can still go to small markets and find little shortwave radios that sell for about $20 or $25. That can be a lot of money for some of the people there. But it's amazing to travel to the countryside and talk to some of the campesinos, the small farmers. And in myself doing that, I've found out, you know, these people are just as informed as I am, as you are, to what's happening around the world. And you talk a little bit more and you find out that they have a shortwave radio setting up on the shelf, and they're listening to maybe the BBC Spanish or Havana Cuba or something, and they're getting their information from these sources on shortwave, and they thusly keep very well informed.
So it is possible to be well informed using shortwave.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There are some 3,000 plus shortwave stations around the world. Some of them are very small, and they serve like communities in Peru, for example, to very large international broadcasters. And RFPI, Radio for Peace International, was sort of a medium-sized station. It was it wasn't as large, obviously, as the BBC or Radio Netherlands, but we did have a sizable audience that was building all the time. And, you know, you would get letters from people who lived in the forest in Bolivia, for example, that were really remote and small town village, to people who are living on a boat in the Panama Canal area, to people who are in the islands in the Caribbean. You get these interesting letters from a scattering of listeners around the world. And over the years, there's been some interesting projects that the radio station was involved with. I remember, as an example of this, during the time that Aristide was exiled from Haiti, and in that country, all of the radio stations were shut down by the coup leaders. There was no radio station broadcasting at all. Aristide and many of the people who fled to the U.S. Produced some radio programs, a show called Radio Negmawang, which was broadcast to the people of Haiti. So we were one of the few stations broadcasting in French Creole at that time to the people of Haiti. And we were like the number one station for something like 6 months in Haiti. And it was marvelous. In addition to that, they also broadcast programs in English, so the rest of us also were informed as far as what is happening in this country of Haiti. So there's been a multitude of programs like that that we've had over the years that I think really served a particular group of people around the world.
Can you give me an example? You mentioned that letters were received from people in remote areas. What would some of the letters say?
Often, some of the common things that you would see again and again and again was, we don't see this in our local media. You know, this information is totally new to us. We thank you for broadcasting it. Oftentimes, the people were very poor. So, you know, they would apologize for not being able to send in a donation or something like this. But time and time again, they commented that the local media simply did not cover these topics. If they did, they were not covered in any kind of intense way. And that was the theme that ran through. And I should mention that the radio station, Radio for Peace International, shares a lot of programs with the Pacifica Network. A lot of the producers that are on Pacifica, Amy Goodman's show, the National Radio Projects, Making Contact, all these shows, Free Speech Radio News, Sue Supriano, Stepping Out of Babylon, all these programs have been around. These are our English programming that we broadcast out, and they have been sent out around the world. So you have some listeners out there that, you know, a campesino living in Nicaragua that happens to have English as a second language who tune these programs in, and he sees a different perspective of what the U.S. policy is. And he says, you know, not everybody in the U.S. is following lockstep with the president of the U.S.'s policies. There are people there that disagree, that have another opinion and other information. And I know we were approached by a head of an agricultural union who came to us one day and said, you know, I don't agree with everything you broadcast, but I really like the station, and I want you to help us set up a station like this for our own self. We wanted to apply for a community radio license. And so another aspect of Radio for Peace International was training of people who've come through the door, some 360 people since our 16 years in our 16 years of operation have come through the radio station and received training at RFPI. Not all from the Central American region, some from Europe and some from North America, Bangladesh, India. I mean, we have quite a group of people who've taken the training and the coursework at the radio station and have gone back, set up a community radio station in some cases, a low-power FM station, and got involved with radio broadcasting.
What's the role of shortwave radio in the peace movement or in the movement to reclaim media?
You know, it is interesting. There perhaps are several roles that the radio station has really been involved with. One is to, some years ago, I took a map of the United States, and I took every community station that I could find, and I drew their reception zone around the station. And I looked at that map of the U.S., and I realized that you could take all those zones of reception, and if you squeezed them over, you can fill up a state like California and Oregon. And it tells you how much area is left outside the coverage of community radio. I myself grew up in an area that did not have a Pacifica affiliate or a Pacifica station. It was only commercial radio. And there are many people that occurs. So one role that we play in this reclaiming is to let people know that there is such a thing as alternative media, and thusly they get it, you know, exposed to programs like Counterspin and Making Contact and all these things and all these ideas. And I think that motivates them to just thinking about why is it that their community doesn't have a community radio station. I remember a young woman in college, Antioch, who set up her own little pirate radio station, a little FM station on campus, and started broadcasting some of the programs and producing some of the programs. So we can serve that role. Also, international radio plays a important role in the geopolitical field, in that when the President of the United States or the President of South Africa want to make a message, get a message out there, they go and their messages are broadcast internationally on shortwave. All of a sudden, there's a voice now, an independent voice, that is saying, you know, these borders don't matter. The idea of peace and social justice does. The issue of the struggle against globalization really matters to people, no matter where they are in the world. And you could start to see some of the similar ideas and beliefs that sort of growing out from Central America, North America, Africa, and other places, the concerns of the people start to come out. And so, well, shortwave radio is tends to be the medium of these governments, the voices of whatever country, or religious broadcasters. Now people seemingly have a voice, a little channel. It's very small, but it is out there, and it's important. Radio for Peace sort of broke into this new field. If you look in some of the publications that cover shortwave broadcasting, and they kind of categorize, you know, this is an international government station, this is a religious broadcaster, and there's a few commercial broadcasters on international, not many, probably some 20 or so worldwide. RFPI, Radio for Peace International, was really one of the few, or the only, community radio, you know, listener-supported radio stations on international broadcasting.
Okay. And internet, would you say internet's role is similar in the reclaiming?
I think it has a very important role in doing that. Obviously, everybody, producers, very small producers on very limited budgets, can now put their program up on the internet and get their message out. And we're seeing a lot of that. And as they get more and more involved with that and they get feedback from listeners, then they sharpen their techniques, their programming becomes better defined. And I think it's a very good way for the individual and a very cost-effective way for individuals to set up and have internet broadcasting. Again, the problem about that is I have seen various people in Latin America try to internet broadcast, and the speeds and the cost are just not there for them, and they're not able to do that. I think what is going to evolve in these countries of the South is possibly more and more FM, low-power FM-type transmissions. Perhaps shortwave and AM radio will also play a part in that as well. Internet, can work. I think in these countries, such as Costa Rica and others, you have to put up the program not for live streaming, but you place it on the internet somewhere, and you produce your program once a week and you place it on the internet. And I see that evolving and starting to take place from countries of the South.
How would you respond to someone who says, "Oh, it's really too bad that RFPI was shut down, but it doesn't affect me, say, here in the U.S. or far from Costa Rica"?
I think anybody that has a concern about censorship, and that's really why RFPI was shut down, was as a matter of censorship. It was a disagreement with what we were presenting on the air. And I think that people that are concerned about censorship should be very concerned about this, the shutting down of this station. And, you know, as the station manager of RFPI and listening to all the programs over the years, I have heard a lot of that, a censorship of this station, that station, this programmer. And until it happens to you, you don't realize what it's like having your voice taken away. You know, go through a day not speaking to anybody, and see what that's like, and see the frustration of such a thing. Also, the fact that we have had the listeners writing in who all of a sudden are left with a shortwave radio, and on that dial there is no RFPI. It's missing. It's vacant. A lot of concern for myself and others have been voiced for the fact that in the United States there is four or five radio stations that broadcast hate programming on shortwave internationally. And these are like populist, right-wing radio stations that are very much right of Rush Limbaugh. In fact, they look at Rush Limbaugh as being very much a liberal. And those stations still exist. Those stations still broadcast their hate programming around the world. And the concern is that those stations have an effect on listeners around the world. Listeners tuning in will hear some of that programming and will be attracted to its message and sort of regurgitate that information to other people in their communities. I've seen this happen personally, where I've met a Costa Rican who was a shortwave listener wanting to work on his English, tuned into the very powerful right-wing shortwave stations beaming out of the U.S., and would start to voice some of these themes that were broadcast on these stations from programs that were sponsored by Aryan Nations or the National Alliance. And I would ask them, well, where did you get this information? Where are you listening? Knowing that it was being tuned into. And they would say, well, it was from the U.S. stations. You know, I mean, it was a U.S. licensed station. It must be okay. After all, the government of the United States has licensed it. And so there is a big concern about this, that this this sort of thing happens and is continuing on. And now it goes pretty much unchecked. There is no progressive left station out on shortwave that is taking some of those ideas that is being voiced by the right to task and correcting it, if you will.
What can be done about that? What can people do to help to get a more peaceful voice on the air?
Well, I mean, hopefully we'll have RFPI back. I think what we needed to do is trying to promote, and we tried to do this at one time, more RFPI stations on shortwave. After all, in a sense, one of the problems I see with FM stations, and let's say in the United States, you have a station that is operating 24 hours a day, and often as not, it's filled up with programmers, and there are programmers waiting in the wings to get their program on, and maybe they can only get their program on once a month if they're lucky, and they're not happy about it. That's because there's only one frequency in a market, perhaps, that is in a given area that can broadcast, you know, are willing to broadcast progressive programming, alternative media. And one of the things that shortwave can do is that you're not really stuck with one frequency. Shortwave stations, our station had three transmitters. We could have had a dozen or 24 or 48 transmitters broadcasting different programming to different parts of the world. So this is a lot broader and a lot more available in a way, especially if there are programmers that are wanting to get their message on. When Pacifica had their difficulties and some of the programmers were pulled off of Pacifica, we had some of them coming to us and asking, could you play our program? Or when a station, through changes in programming, a programmer was cut from one of the Pacifica stations, we'd often get a phone call from them saying, hey, I'd like to get my program on and be heard. Can you do this? Well, they're doing that on internet as well, but now they can do it on internet in shortwave. So I think that this gives some availability. And if you want to see the success of shortwave radio, all you have to do is look at what the far right have done with, a massive, high-powered shortwave transmissions that beam their signal around the world. So now the far right people in the U.S., such as the Aryan Nations or National Alliance, can be heard in Germany, where such broadcasts would not be permitted on a local station, or in Australia or elsewhere. They were very effective at moving into this medium and using it for their own needs.
Why is that they're so quote unquote successful?
I think if you look at the far right history in radio, going back to like Father Coughlin in the 30s and 40s, you see that there was some real successes that Father Coughlin had in his anti-Semitic broadcast, and he grew quite a listening audience during this period of time. But the downfall of it all was the advertisers on the local stations. I think he had some more than 600 radio stations that his hate programming was being broadcast on. And the people in those local stations would protest against the station. They'd say, I'm going to pull my advertising dollars away from you. I don't like what Father Coughlin is saying about supporting Hitler and Nazi Germany, this sort of thing. And so this very intense radio empire that he had founded started to crumble as people in the local markets started to complain. Shortwave, though, if you go to Nashville, Tennessee, and ask about the local shortwave station there, most people in Nashville, Tennessee have no clue as to what that station is. You know, WWCR. They have no idea what's broadcast on that station, and they don't advertise on it, because that station will sell a half hour or an hour program block to a far right group. And there may be 10 people or 20 people in Nashville that listen to that station, but everybody else is quite removed from that area. So you don't have the problem of challenging the station's income. The station is making income, the shortwave station is, by selling an hour-long slot on their program guide to a far-right group. So they're able to get away with that, and that's what's sort of developed. The far-right knows, extremist group, they know very much it's very important to get that message out, to get it out in whatever form, on text, on internet broadcasting, on shortwave, maybe on a network of AM stations. And they know that it's crucial to keep going and recruiting and recruiting and getting more people informed to their particular point of view. So shortwave was a real answer to these groups, and they're broadcasting worldwide from one radio station that didn't seem to be intimidated by advertisers.
So how about the listener who says, I want to help, I want to do something about this, I want to help balance out the voices. What can they do?
I think that, they can get involved. I think we have to not limit ourselves to thinking we have X amount of FM stations, we have the Pacifica network, we have these independents. I think what we need is a lot more radio stations. We need to look at creating new outlets for this progressive thought. to get more exposure, to get more people listening. I think that just having a few stations is not enough. I think it's very crucial that the listeners support community radio and understand the importance of that. I think it's also very important that they understand that the producers that stand behind those stations are struggling often with very limited resources to produce their shows and to get them out there, and that they're making tremendous sacrifice in terms of their efforts of trying to get these alternative voices on the air. And, you know, to support those organizations is very, very critical. I think there is a need in the world today for Radio for Peace International to get it back on the air, to support us financially as well, so that we can bring, you know, some 50 radio programs back onto the shortwave area, and to start countering this message that the far right is right now dominating out there. I think all these things, it can really make a difference. It can change people's lives. I remember getting a letter from a listener in Utah who said, after listening to your shows, I now think about what I consume, what are the products I consume, who makes those products, how they get paid, and, you know, what effect on the environment those products are having. You know, so every day now, the way myself and my son is, you know, we're living, we're considering this, you know, what impact we're having on the planet and what effect we are having on others. And I think those kind of testimonials coming into us, that's what always motivated us to continue on to making the sacrifice of continuing on these broadcasts. It's so important.
You mentioned that there were a number of right-wing shortwave stations that broadcast out of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
How many left or peaceful shortwave stations are broadcasting out of the U.S.?
Unfortunately, there isn't any. There is the Voice of America. Okay. Then you have religious broadcasters. Most of them, more than half, are missionary broadcasters broadcasting in various languages for their missions in Africa, Asia, or Latin America. And then, as I said, there are a number of these transmitters that are very high power. More powerful than the Voice of America in some cases, better heard in other parts of the world, that transmit far-right programming, you know, around the globe.
And again, why is that? Is that due to lack of resources, or
for in terms of why aren't why
there's a dearth of the left,
mm-hmm,
or peacefulness and all the right coming out? That's quite, to me, surprising.
Considering the cost of building a shortwave station, it can be less than if you were going to buy an FM station in a major market. It is surprising, I think. And I think it would be very interesting to investigate how to, you know, think of a Pacifica network that would get involved with a shortwave outlet in the United States to broadcast its programs, to fill up all those areas that are blank that cannot receive them would be a marvelous idea. I would certainly encourage that. I think that we're stuck in this role of you know, we got these stations and, you know, we need to support them, and we certainly do. But I think what is needed now, because of this abundance of programming, when we first set up the station at RFPI, we thought, well, we're going to produce all these shows ourselves. You know, we got down there with a crew of about 8 people, and we thought, no, that's not going to work out. We don't have enough people to do this. And then we found out there was a multitude of programs in environment, social justice, peace, disarmament that were out there already. We did not have to, you know, reinvent the wheel. They were already there. The problem was is they had very few outlets. And so we provided them yet another outlet so they could, you know, voice their stuff. So I think we have to go beyond thinking about this
in some respects, our vision is a bit limited on the progressive left in terms of our media work. We need to think about how to get low-power FM up and running and going in this country, in the United States and around the world. We need to think about what other options are there besides the internet where we can, you know, actually cover yet another area of it, shortwave radio being one. What about all those other AM stations that are laying defunct? What about clear channel AM stations that can cover 20 states, you know? What about something like that and getting involved in buying some of those stations so that you can really expand the coverage of what you do? I think that we have to have a more forward-looking plan as progressives towards our media involvement. And I think that that's been lacking. And I think that we need to now really evaluate what has worked for the right. You know, they seemingly have done some things and have some success in doing it. How can we devise a plan that will cover more voices, bring more voices to the airwaves, and get the word out to more people? And I see that as increasing the number of stations that that we really operate from.
Thank you. And I don't know how much more time we have, but if there's anything else you'd like to add that we haven't covered.
I think we covered it all.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I hope that came out all right. I know we covered a little bit of area and a little bit of ground, but
yeah.
I always want to mention the far right's
yeah.
activity. It's very important because...
Yeah.
They're a dangerous lot.
Yeah, it's funny because it's like, you know, you don't want to censor. You know, at one point I wanted to say, well, how can we get them off the air? But it's
mm-hmm.
like, get them off the air slash counter their voice.
It's really countering. I mean, there was a big debate at our radio station regarding this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And because some of the people came from an issue of, oh, we can't censor. And I understand
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Now I understand it even more.
Yeah.
And you don't want to censor. But what you need to do, there's another element of